This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. One of my vivid childhood memories is rummaging through my mother's closet and trying on all of her shoes. She had kept most of them from her teenage years and had kept up with fashion as a young mother in the 1950s. While my collection is not as vast, I must admit I love the shoes in my closet. My guest, Rochelle Bergstein, also loves shoes and has written a book that explores women's fascination with and passion for footwear. It's called Women from the Ankle Down, the story of shoes and how they define us. Her book begins in the early 20th century with young Salvatore Ferragamo, who was living and growing up in a small Italian village, and it ends with a description of a contemporary designer named Jeffrey Campbell, who started his company in his garage. And our guest, Rochelle Bergstein, joins us from the NPR studios in New York, and nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Oh, thank you for having me, Marty.
So how big is your collection of shoes?
It's growing. I have, well, now 76 pairs of shoes.
You do? 76 pairs.
I do. I'd like to say that nothing enables a shoe addict like writing a book about shoes.
research, right?
Exactly.
So are they scattered all over your apartment or your house in New York?
Well, as you probably know, New York City apartments are not known for their size or their closet space.
Exactly.
So I have to get creative. Let me say, I have a very tolerant husband. I have shelving in my bedroom that's devoted to my favorite pairs of shoes. So they're actually part of the decor.
Oh, wow. I wish this were television and not radio, but is there a certain style that you love?
Yes, I gravitate towards boots, I have to say, and I write about that at the end of the book.
Yes.
I say that actually kind of masculine, edgy shoes are what really drew me to footwear. I like the combination of hard and soft in shoes.
In fact, Doc Martens, right?
Yes. I felt so cool when I put on my first pair of Doc Martens, and I got the magic of shoes at 13 years old.
And still wear Doc Martens with the leggings and the frilly dresses and things like that?
I do. I have to say I've stepped away from the frilly dresses a little bit, but I wear them with shorts in the summer. I actually did a presentation at a local library where I brought a bunch of pairs of shoes to discuss, and I held up a pair of floral Doc Martens, which to me are perfection because they're so feminine and so masculine. And someone in the audience said, "Well, what do you wear those with?"
silly question.
Yes.
So, have you thrown out pairs of shoes, or your 76 pairs is a lifelong collection?
You know, I do get rid of some. I donate them, and I have a generational shoe problem because my mother loves shoes as well, and she buys them on sale and then realizes that they don't fit her right, and we do share a shoe size, so she passes them down. So she has helped me create this prolific shoe collection.
Well, you wrote this book in part to tell some of this history, but also to explore this question that has fascinated both men and women, which is why women love shoes so much. Have you come up with an answer to that question?
Well, I have an answer that I find satisfying, which is this. The obvious reasons are absolutely true. Shoes are beautiful. Shoes are little pieces of art that you can wear on your feet. A lot of women have angst about their bodies, but that doesn't necessarily extend to their feet. So when they put on a pair of shoes, they don't have the same second guesses that they do when they put on a dress. But it does go deeper than that. And what I found when I looked into the history of shoes is that they have, for a long time, been connected to ideas of social value and economic status and sexuality and strength and ambition. And they have evolved to communicate all of these subtle but very important social cues. And I do think that's why shoes are so popular to this day.
Well, you do make a reference, and I've done a whole interviews about Chinese women, 1,000 years ago or more. They tended to be upper class women having their feet bound. And I've seen pictures of what their feet look like. It's actually horrifying. And slipping their feet into 3-inch shoes. But, it was designed to essentially hobble these women, but became a tradition for some time.
Yes, it's wild. It was willful deforming. And it was done, as you said, mostly through the upper classes.
Yeah.
It was considered a privilege. And one of the reasons why is because it signaled, which, very high-heeled shoes do to this day, that those women didn't have to work. You know, if you don't have to walk, then you don't have to work. And that is a sign of status, as crazy as it sounds.
Right. You also touch on a sort of a quick history, but focusing largely on 20th century and contemporary times. But you look at Europe, 14th to 17th century, and you see, you know, shoe design showing up in class, how long the fronts of the shoes could be. And that would tell, I guess, someone's status.
Yes, there was a very kind of exotic looking shoe called the Poulain.
Yes.
And it has a long toe that almost is elfin. But it became so popular. It started, of course, with the upper crust, and it trickled down through the masses. And it became so popular that there were actually laws dictating that only the aristocracy could wear Poulains of a certain length. These shoes were telling people which class that they belonged to. And then, of course, in the courts of Louis XIV, we see something similar, which is that Louis made a law that only aristocratic men could wear shoes with red heels.
Mm.
And so again, we're seeing shoes evolving to communicate status.
Well, and just to jump to the 20th century, as you describe, it was really the shoe factory allowed individuals, men and women, but women to own more than one pair of shoes because they weren't so expensive. And you had some choice besides what the cobbler would come up with on the street corner.
Right, right. The cobbler was a huge business before industrialization, and a family would expect a pair of shoes to last through a generation of sisters, for instance. Mm-hmm. So you'd buy a pair of shoes, and then the younger sister would inherit them, and the younger sister would inherit them. So quality was very important. And, you know, aside from the aristocratic women who could bend fashion to their whims, most people could only afford to buy a few pairs of shoes that weren't expected to last a long time.
And then comes the shoe factory.
And then comes the 20th century, and everything changes. You know, materials became a lot less expensive. When you look back before the 20th century, we're using mostly leather to create shoes. And now we have so many options for man-made artificial fabrics. So plastics and PVC and, you know, all of these things that we can use to make shoes to lower the cost.
Well, and for the flappers, and I think when we have an image, when you think of flappers, you know, going kind of crazy at the speakeasies or whatever, dancing around with their short, flouncy little skirts and a pretty cool pair of shoes as well.
Yes, flappers were one of the first groups of young women to put their shoes on display. Mm. Their hemlines got shorter, and because of that, their shoes became more of a focus. And what they needed in shoes were shoes that were sexy, but also would stay on their feet as they danced through the night. So a high-heeled shoe with a T-strap and an ankle strap became very popular because they wouldn't fly off.
Well, and those are pretty popular styles today.
They are. I'm actually wearing a T-strap sandal right now, and I'm looking down and I'm thinking, these started with the flappers.
Well, your book interestingly starts with Salvatore Ferragamo. I think people know about the very fancy, very expensive Ferragamo shoes that one can buy today. But this was a man that sounds like he grew up poor, grew up in a little village in Italy.
Yes, I love this story, and I think it's one that everyone can relate to. Salvatore Ferragamo grew up in Bonito, Italy. It's a very tiny town. He is one of 14 brothers and sisters.
Wow.
And he had a very modest upbringing, and the children were expected to contribute to the family in some way from a very young age. So Ferragamo said to his father, "I would like to be a shoemaker." And his father said, "Absolutely not. Shoemaking is not a respectable industry. You can be a tailor. You can be a carpenter. It's amazing. Shoemaking was the bottom of the totem pole." And what changed his father's mind is that on the evening before his Salvatore Ferragamo's younger sister's communion, his mother ran up and down the streets looking for a pair of white shoes that she could wear to the church because she didn't have any. And she was humiliated to think that she was going to have to send her daughter in ill-fitting or dirty shoes to get her first communion. And so Salvatore, who was a young boy, waited until everyone went to sleep, and then he snuck across the street to the local cobbler's shop, where he asked to borrow canvas and shoemaking materials. And he stayed up all through the night making pairs of shoes for his sisters to wear to the communion. And when his mother woke up the next morning, she was overjoyed that her youngest son had helped out this way. So his father said, "Fine, Salvatore, you can go apprentice with the cobbler." And the rest is history.
Well, it sounds just like a fairy tale, doesn't it?
It really does. It really does. It has that magical element.
Right, exactly. And eventually he ends up in Hollywood and is designing, you know, shoes for celebrities and stars.
Yes. He moved out to California to meet his brothers who were working for a shoe factory. And at that point, he was only 14, but he had already established a shoemaking business back in Italy in his hometown. And when he ended up in California, his brothers took him through the shoe factory, and he was absolutely horrified to see the craft that he so loved reduced to an assembly line. And so he decided he was going to make shoes by hand in America, regardless of what the trend was. And he did just that, and he actually got connected to the film industry, where at that time, just before the Golden Age in Hollywood, they were doing a lot of Westerns, a lot of period pieces, a lot of epics. And so he ended up making boots for Westerns and Gresham sandals for the Ten Commandments, and Cecil B. DeMille in particular really liked his work.
Well, and that famous picture of Marilyn Monroe in that famous movie, The 7-Year Itch, where she's kind of holding her dress down, she's wearing Ferragamos, right?
Yes. That came a little bit later, but by the 1950s, he was actually back in Italy, but he was well established within Hollywood, and so many pairs of shoes from that era in film history were made by Ferragamo. So the stilettos that Marilyn wears when she's standing over the subway grate are him, as well as the shoes that Lana Turner wears in The Postman Always Rings Twice, in that famous shot where the camera locks in on her feet and then slowly rises up to reveal her beautiful face. And we know that the male protagonist is done.
The shoes tell the whole story, do they not?
Yes.
And we're almost up in a break here, but you also write about Judy Garland's ruby slippers, and who can forget that, right? The idea of clicking your feet together and you end up in a fantasy land.
Yes, I think
or you
ruby
go
slippers
home, actually, yeah.
Are probably the most iconic pair of shoes in American history. You know, they continue to impact so many women. I've met a lot of girls and women who still say that they have a red shoe thing because of that film.
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation with Rochelle Bergstein. We are talking about shoes, one of my favorite topics. She's the author of a new book called Women from the Ankle Down, The Story of Shoes and How They Define Us. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. And after this very short break, we'll be talking with two brothers who own a vintage and retail sneaker store in Camden, New Jersey. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Chester County Hospital supports WHYY and is committed to delivering comprehensive care in an environment where respect, compassion, and quality come first. To learn how they help make lives better every day, ChesterCountyHospital.org.
To the women who say they are not feminists, Catelyn Moran asks,
what part of liberation for women is not for you? Is it the freedom to vote? The right not to be owned by the man that you marry?
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Moran about her new book, How to Be a Woman. It's a bestseller in Britain. She's a columnist for the Times of London. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. A one-time climate change skeptic now says global warming is real and for the most part humans cause it. Also from the 100-meter dash to the decathlon, yay, it's track and field time in London. That's Public Radio's daily digest of news and culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
WHYY is supported by Works for me. Funded by CMS grant CFDA number 93.768. Works for me offers hiring tips, training, and help finding employees. Details at worksforme-pa.org/employer.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, and I'm talking with Rochelle Bergstein. She's the author of a new book called Women from the Ankle Down, The Story of Shoes and How They Define Us. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. And we have two brothers who have joined us by telephone. Darian Gans and Byron Gans are the owners of Shoe Kings, and that's a vintage and retail sneaker store in Camden, New Jersey, across the river from us here in Philadelphia. Darian, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
How you doing, Marty?
I'm good. How are you?
Okay.
And Byron, how are you doing?
And how are you doing, Marty?
I'm doing great. Well, if we're talking about shoes, I'm doing fine. Now, Byron, I have to, and to you, Darian, as well. Rochelle said that she has 76 pairs of shoes. Byron, do you know how many shoes you have?
Well, actually, oddly enough, I think about a week ago, I just started like tallying my own. About 400 or 500 pairs.
Oh no! Really?
Yeah, that's light. That's his little collection. Yeah.
Is that you, Byron?
Yeah.
Okay. And how about for you, Darian?
I want to say at least 1,000 pair.
Really?
Yeah.
Now, we're talking sneakers here, right, Darian?
Yeah, sneakers.
So when did you two start buying, collecting, holding on to your sneakers, Darian?
Probably since the late '80s. My brother started really collecting sneakers. So, yeah, I'll say about the late '80s, early '90s.
And why was that, Byron? You just love them?
Well, you know, it was always a part of our everyday life routine. Just the culture, and just wearing sneakers. You know, during the time, it was a very groundbreaking time as far as hip hop culture, fashion. And it was just like a lot of brands were competing. It was just a very, very influential time for footwear. So it was like if you had a pair of your favorite shoe, you wanted to get multiple pairs of that shoe. So it was just, you know, it started off as a personal project. You know, but then as time, you know, went on and times changed, we got older, we saw the marketplace changing, we saw the demand for certain styles changing, so we kind of got a light bulb went off on our head early in, and we just decided to continue to do that. It's fun.
Yes, it sounds like fun. Darian, going back to you, I know that you sell vintage sneakers, and I'm curious about, you know, what has been, I guess, the most unique pair of sneakers that you've sold or that you've had in your store?
Well, we've had the original Gucci sneakers. 1984.
Oh.
That's like the Bigfoot of the sneaker world. I spent a lot of my rent money to get them, but you know, it was a demand for that, and they actually remade those, but you know, just to have the originals from that time.
So how much did you pay?
Oh. Yeah, a few $100s, you
really?
Know. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Rochelle, let me get you in on the conversation because your book is about the history of largely women's shoes, but you also talk about the 1980s and Reebok had this freestyle. Oh, these guys like that. This freestyle sneaker that they marketed to women. Can you talk a bit about that, Rochelle?
Yes. The freestyle is a really important shoe. Because it was one of the first sneakers to cater exclusively to women. And New Balance did the W320 in the late 70s, and that was a men's shoe that they adapted to women because they picked up on the fact that women were starting to work out. But the Freestyle by Reebok was the first shoe that was designed exclusively for female athletes. And what that said is that women were valid to be doing aerobics, which was very trendy at the time, and Reebok tapped into this momentum. So that's a great shoe, and it's a classic.
Well, and I heard both you, Darian, and you, Byron, going, "Oh,
talking
about the Reebok Freestyle." Byron, what do you sell women's shoes at your store, or is it strictly men?
No, oddly enough, women's shoes, the big problem or the issue with a lot of women's shoes early in time was a lot of women had a lot of different colorways for shoes, so that made the shoe more appealing visually. So as a result of that, it's funny, but a lot of men, a lot of young men, a lot of guys purchase women's shoes because of the colorways. And I wear like a size, I'm an 8.5, 8. So in the women's, I'm a size 10.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so in the women's, and you know, as far as women's footwear in the sneaker world, that's a big deal. So it actually pushed us to carry more women's footwear, different styles and things like that. And as Rachel said, Reebok, even today, the sleekness of the shoe, the way that the shoe feels on the foot, and they led the way as far as aerobics in the 80s. So it's definitely it was definitely a big impact.
And I'm seeing Jane Fonda as the three of you were talking.
Yeah, we have those shoes.
Oh, you do?
Yeah.
Those, the L.A. Gear.
Yeah.
I got a lot of L.A. Gear.
Yeah, Billie Jean King Adidas she endorsed.
Yeah, so we got a lot of women's stuff. Yeah. So we just need shoe sizes from you and
No, we can't do that. No, we appreciate the offer, but we can't do that. Rochelle, you had mentioned that you have 76 pairs of shoes. Are any of those sneakers? Are you a sneaker person now?
I'm actually not much of a sneaker person, but I feel totally outranked by these guys.
Oh, no.
I'm going to tell my husband that at least I don't have 500 or 1,000 pairs. But no, I do have a pair of old school Reeboks that are high top, and they're really cool. They're bright blue with red stripes, but that's probably my best pair of sneakers.
Okay.
No, I loved your story, though, as we can relate to the thrill of it, you know, the love of it. You know, like you said, the shoe is like a work of art that you put on. And I enjoyed that. So, yeah, I can relate to that.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Well, and Darian and Byron, I was reading about your store, and it sounds a bit like it's a kind of a cross between a retail store and a museum. I mean, it sounds like you have things there that in a shoe museum might look very, very appropriate. Darian?
Yeah. A lot of the stuff, like the old posters or that stuff from my childhood, you know, it's just a love from then. And I just started putting stuff on the wall, and it started adding up, and I'm like a hoarder right now, but it's okay.
There's a show for you. Show for you, just so you know.
I turn it every time. I'm like, I can use that, you know. But no. People love it. They love it.
Yeah, and you know, also,
Byron,
when we were searching for shoes and just beginning new friendships with other business owners and things like that, we ran into antiquities. So our store is littered with cabinetry and elaborate glass shelving and things like that. And it kind of, we say our store kind of it built itself. It took on a life of its own. And, you know, you see that within the decor of it.
Well, it sounds great. And do either of you still play basketball? I know you did in I guess, high school. You went to Camden High School. Darian?
Yeah, I mean, I throw the ball around a little bit, you know.
We know what that means.
You know.
How about you, Byron?
Well, you know, I didn't play basketball. That was mainly, like, after school at the recreation programs, just with our friends after hours. But I never really, you know. But we were always a part of the basketball program here in Camden, New Jersey, with the Camden High Panthers and just the whole legacy of basketball. Woodrow Wilson High School. It's a big basketball town.
Well, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times. And good luck with your store as well.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I got to get the book. I got a copy of that book.
Yeah, where can we get that?
I have to get down to your store. Yeah, you can turn into a sneakerhead.
Oh, yeah. We got it. And you got to give us, well, you know, we're in New York a lot.
You know what we'll do? We'll take care of this off the air. We'll hook you all up off the air. How's that? All right.
Okay,
terrific.
Thank you so much. Thanks a lot.
You're very welcome. And that's Darian Gans and Byron Gans, and they own Shoe Kings. It's a vintage and retail sneaker store in Camden, New Jersey. Staying with us for the rest of the hour is Rochelle Bergstein, and she's the author of a new book called Women from the Ankle Down, The Story of Shoes and How They Define Us. And we do have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Rochelle, I have to say, I really enjoy the camaraderie between the three of you as you were waxing on about shoes and sneakers. Do you run into this a lot?
Yes, I do. I have to say, when I've told people what I'm writing about, you know, because I researched this book for 4 years, so many women, their eyes lit up and they said, oh my gosh, I love shoes. And conversely, when I spoke to men, So many men said the same thing. Oh, my God, my wife is Imelda Marcos. You have to get this book to her. So women do have this in common. And, you know, male sneakerheads are equally invested in shoes.
Well, let me march through a little bit more of this history that we started. We were talking a bit about just the shoe factory and how that really revolutionized women's access to shoes and also the kind of variety of shoes as well. You also write about World War II. And obviously many women were working in factories and there were shortages and much done for the war effort. How did that affect shoe design, shoe wearing in the U.S.?
This was one of my favorite discoveries through the research process because I found out that shoes were actually rationed during the war. And that really surprised me because, of course, I've heard of, you know, gasoline rationing and sugar rationing and all of these different items. And it makes sense that leather and steel would be allocated to the army during wartime as well. But shoes were the first wearable item to be rationed. And not only were people told how many shoes that they could buy, but shoe manufacturers were actually limited in what they could make. Mm. They weren't allowed to make shoes in certain colors. They weren't allowed to add any flourishes just for aesthetic reasons. They had to make practical shoes. And it's funny because the War Board announced this in 1943, and they only allowed one day between when they announced it and the ration went into effect, and that was to prevent shoe hoarding. So after the freeze day, shoe stores opened, and people ran to them to collect on shoes. And what was interesting is that a lot of women bought impractical shoes. You know, they bought shoes that they understood would disappear from the market, and they might not have a place to wear them during the war, but they wanted to have them. And of course, as the war progressed and women were working in factories, they started buying proper shoes for work.
Well, you even quote somebody that says ration tickets were turned in right and left for frivolous, bold-colored leather sandals, spike-heeled suede dress shoes, and high-pump styles of all kinds on this one day when I guess women could buy as many shoes as that ration card would allow them.
Yeah, I suppose that the impractical, beautiful shoes were just a promise of a better day. You know, women wanted to be optimistic and believe that once the war was over and their husbands came home, they would be able to go out and look beautiful again.
And moving into the 1950s, and this is when I was a little girl, and as I began, I was talking about my mother's shoes and her shoe closet, which was a wonderful place to go exploring. It seemed that women wanted to wear high heels and have maybe less kind of practical shoes at that in that decade.
Yes, this is a very complicated era. And when the war came to a close, women were evicted from their jobs as quickly as they were told that it was their patriotic duty to join the workforce. So it left a lot of women feeling kind of underappreciated because they had done all of this work and felt very satisfied, and then were told that it was their new patriotic duty to go home and start a family and take care of their husbands. As sort of the silver lining, fashions really changed, and they celebrated femininity and the female form. Christian Dior debuted the new look in 1947, and it was kind of scandalous because after all of these years of deprivation, he put these very swingy, long skirts onto the runway that used tons of excess fabric. And he partnered with Roger Vivier to design these shoes, which were new. The stiletto is a 20th century technological innovation. Once steel came back into the market and shoemakers had access to it, they were able to make a shoe that they had been fantasizing about for many years, which was this very narrow heeled shoe, which is called the stiletto, and we still have to this day. The 1950s stiletto was a lot lower than what we see today from women. You know, we see women wearing 4 or 5 inch heels. It was more like 2 or 3 inch, but it was not a practical shoe. It was not something that you'd wear to a factory. And fashion was participating in this idea that women were now to look beautiful and to go home.
Do you think the stiletto is about sex?
I do. I do. I think the stiletto is a very sexy shoe, and actually one of the first things that made it popular before it was even available for women to buy and wear were the pinups that artists were drawing during the war. So if you look at pictures of the Varga girls from the 1940s, a lot of them are wearing these fantasy shoes,
oh, wow,
which have a very, very, very narrow heel. And, you know, that idea of what a beautiful woman should wear actually translated to fashion.
And I'm curious, how high a heel have you ever tried to, not just put on your foot, but tried to walk in?
Oh, well, I do tend to stay below a 4-inch heel,
right,
because I think if you can't walk, you can't feel powerful. But I think I have tried on a 5-inch heel and felt, I'm 5'7", so I felt very tall.
Right. But you know what I noticed today, we're kind of jumping around here, but today the extraordinarily high heels, but also flats. I mean, flats seem to have made a kind of a comeback.
Yeah, I think flats have they have a cool legacy. You know, Audrey Hepburn wore flats. Jackie Kennedy wore flats. They're a shoe that's associated with a kind of quirky but no-nonsense woman. And, you know, today we see such a multiplicity of shoes that are in style at a given time. When you look back at the 30s, 40s, 50s, there were really only one or two or three shoe styles that were on trend in a given moment. Now we see 15.
Mm.
So we see incredibly high stilettos in fashion, but we also see loafers in fashion for women. And part of it, I think, is that when women are wearing these insanely high stilettos and platforms at night, they want to counterbalance that during the day with something more comfortable. And then part of it, I think, is that shoe manufacturers just want us to have so many options so that the average woman feels her shoe wardrobe isn't complete until she has all of these different styles in her closet.
And hence you end up with 76 pairs of shoes, right?
At least it's not 500.
But at least it's not 500. We've had a minute before our break, and then I do want to get to some callers after the break. But you have to tell a story about John Travolta, his Saturday Night Fever turn, obviously, the white suit, but also what was he wearing on his feet?
He was wearing platform loafers, and the 70s are such an interesting time in American history for fashion because it was very eclectic. And, you know, we have disco on one hand and punk rock on the other. And in terms of shoe styles, it was the only time in 20th century history that men and women were both wearing elevated shoes. And it was a very anything-goes era. And, you know, androgyny and very open sexuality were in style. And because of that, I think a certain kind of young man felt comfortable wearing a platform shoe.
Mm.
They were looking to the rock stars they admired, like David Bowie, and seeing them look oh so cool on stage wearing these incredibly high shoes, and men were willing to try it out. We haven't seen that happen since.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation, and we want to get some callers in. Do you have a favorite pair of shoes? Do you love shoes? We want to hear from you. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499, or a story about a pair of shoes. We'll take that as well. 1-888-477-WHYY. Rochelle Bergstein, our guest, author of a book called Women from the Ankle Down, The Story of Shoes and How They Define Us. We'll be right back.
What can you do when your homegrown tomatoes are failures in flavor? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next You Bet Your Garden, we'll take a look at the potential causes of tasteless tomatoes and reveal some last-minute tricks you can try to induce a flavor boost, plus answers to all your growing questions. That's You Bet Your Garden, Saturday morning at 11, right here on WHYY-FM.
Supporting WHYY, the Rutgers School of Business at Camden urges ambitious working professionals in New Jersey and the Delaware Valley to expect more from graduate programs. The Rutgers Professional MBA is a 21-month accelerated program with classes held on Saturdays in Princeton. Rutgers will host an information session at 6 p.m. Thursday, August 2nd at the Princeton Forestal Conference Center. pmba.rutgers.edu or 856-225-2700. Expect more, be more at the Rutgers School of Business in Camden.
playwright, director, and actor Afa Fugard is best known for plays that dramatize the harsh realities of apartheid-era South Africa. And even though apartheid is over and he's in his 80s, he finds he still has a lot to say.
I have a greater sense of adventure at this moment in my life than I ever had in the past.
South Africa's Afa Fugard is with us next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Motz-Cohen. We are talking about shoes. We want to play a scene from the movie In Her Shoes, in which the wild sister Maggie, who's played by Cameron Diaz, goes through her quiet sister's closet and discovers shelves and shelves of shoes. Her sister's name is Rose, and she's played by Toni Collette.
You know, you don't even wear most of these. Shoes like these should not be locked in a closet. They should be living a life of scandal and passion and getting screwed in an alleyway by a billionaire while his frigid wife waits in a limo, thinking that he just went back into the bar to get his cell phone. These are cute, too.
Please tell me you just made that up.
Look, if you're not going to wear them, don't buy them. Leave them for somebody who's going to get something out of them.
I get something out of them. When I feel bad, I like to treat myself. Clothes never look any good. Food just makes me fatter. Shoes always fit.
Shoes always fit. Rochelle, have you bought shoes that you've never worn?
Let me think. I actually do have a pair of shoes I've never worn.
Really?
As embarrassing as that is. And it sounds crazy, but they're almost too beautiful to wear.
Wow.
They're purple suede, and I'm afraid of damaging them. And I thought that was nuts. But then someone recently told me she was wearing a pair of vintage Prada suede shoes. And she said, you know, I almost never wear these because I'm afraid that if I do, I'm going to destroy them. So there's something about having that, again, little work of art in your closet that can bring a smile to your face, even if you don't wear them out.
Well, let me get some callers in on the conversation. We have Michael from Mount Airy joining us on Radio Times. And
hello.
Hi, Michael. Go ahead. You're on the air.
First comment on the stilettos. Yes, they are very sexy. And I can vouch for those. Anyway,
okay.
the only question I had is, why are men's shoes so big and bulky and square and long and ugly?
Oh, dear, Michael, where are you shopping these days?
I mean, I go to DFW with my wife, which she has, I think, about 60 pairs of shoes right
now.
And I have a friend who has 80 pairs. And women's shoes, they are a work of art. Men's shoes just look like they were thrown together. The traditional, you know, shoes for businessmen with a little poke through the holes, I forget, with their wingtips or whatever.
Okay.
And shoes for men are just, I go through DSW, I go up and down those lines, I go to the shoe stores, and I can't find anything I like.
Well, let me, Michael, let me see if Rochelle can help you at all, without giving out name brands or stores. But what do you think, Rochelle?
Well, I do think that some brands are picking up on the fact that men are now interested in fashion as well, and they are working on shoes to appeal to men and tapering the last, which would maybe counterbalance the bulkiness that he's speaking about. But for a long time, I think that designers just haven't focused on men because there's been maybe a misperception that men aren't interested in fashion, that men want one or two versatile pairs of shoes, and that's it, that they can wear with jeans or they could wear with a suit. I think it comes down to this idea, which is very old now, probably dates back into the 18th or 19th century, that men are not frivolous, that men shouldn't be interested in something like fashion, that they're too serious for that. But I think we're seeing that change now.
Mm-hmm.
I think men are taking the way they look seriously as well.
Well, good luck, Michael, and thanks for the call to Radio Times. I mean, if John Travolta can wear wedges, you know, why can't other men, right, Rochelle?
Absolutely. The most adventurous men can give it a try.
In fact, I was thinking of that scene of Pee Wee Herman in those shoes where he's dancing on the bar. I don't know if you saw that movie or not, but he does this absolutely ridiculous dance in these absolutely ridiculous pair of shoes.
I don't know if I've seen it, but Pee Wee Herman, of course, is pretty outrageous, so
yes.
I'm sure that he's wearing something amazing.
Let me see what Carmen from Westchester has to say. And Carmen, go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Good morning.
Hi, good morning.
I have a pair of dress shoes that are, they look like a wingtip, but the wing extends beyond the tip. And I think it's a different named style, but I don't know the name of the style.
And when do you wear these, Carmen?
To work.
To work. And you think of it as a wingtip, but it has more of a wing than a typical wingtip?
Correct. The wing extends all the way to the heel, and someone once told me they're called Stacy Allens.
Can you help her, Sal?
Wow, you know, I've never
know what you're talking about.
I've never heard the term Stacy Allen. I would describe that as a long wing, which is a modification on a wingtip. The short wing is the classic wingtip, and the long wing extends to the heel. But I don't know about Stacy Allen. I'm going to have to look that up.
So it's called a long wing.
A long. Are they comfortable, Carmen?
They are very comfortable and very stylish. I get many compliments.
You go. Well, thanks. Thank you for calling into Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Well, let's go, Rochelle, from the stiletto to the Birkenstock. And that was a shoe, I guess, that became popular, what, in the 60s?
In the 60s, yes. That it would be the opposite of the stiletto.
Exactly.
The Birkenstock is a German sandal that, when they were first debuted in the U.S., were described as the ugliest shoes ever made. And, of course, you know, the Birkenstock isn't known for its aesthetic appeal. It's known to be one of the more comfortable shoes ever. I think it would be like a Croc today.
Exactly.
You know, a shoe that's very foot-friendly and isn't really fashion-oriented. You know, it has a place in fashion because it's popular, but, you know, you wouldn't wear it out to a black tie party. But the Birkenstock was very embraced by the women's liberation movement. You know, when these women in the 1960s were looking at the way their mothers dressed, wearing these cinched waists and these very high heels, clothing that didn't allow for movement, clothing that adjusted a woman's body to what the ideal was rather than celebrated the variety of women's bodies that really exist. And the Birkenstock was an extension of that. It was a great walking shoe, and it wasn't about fashion. It was about function, which is ultimately, you know, where shoes should begin. Well, they cover your feet.
And there still is, I don't know if it's a argument or a debate among feminists about shoes and heels and whether you're whether to wear comfortable shoes or if a stiletto is a feminist statement or not. Does that in any way interest you? Does that seem like a worthwhile debate or conversation to have?
Well, I do think it's interesting because it points to two perspectives on feminism that exist right now. On one hand, you have women saying, it's my body, I can do what I want with it, and if I want to wear a sexy shoe, if I want to wear a short dress, that doesn't make me less of a feminist. That means I feel comfortable in my own skin, and I'm using my assets to my advantage. And then you have, on the other hand, women saying, well, a stiletto is the tool of the patriarchy. It's the modern-day foot binding. If you can't walk properly in a shoe, if you can't run away, if you're being chased down the street, then you're not being your best self. Then you are doing something to look sexy. And it's not a great decision as a woman. And I don't think that we'll ever find middle ground between these two points. You know, I think it's individual at this point.
Well, and I think it's also generational in many ways. And maybe it's the children of the moms in the 50s who wore the Birkenstocks and you know, feel that's a statement of their feminism and perhaps even their femininity.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think what we would describe as second wave feminism, which was the 60s and the 70s, we would say those women tended to be less appearance-oriented than feminists today. You know, that part of the message was rejecting makeup and high heels and tools of the patriarchy, so to speak.
Let me see what Marilyn from Upper Black Eddy has to say. Marilyn, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, well, that's sort of along the lines of what I wanted to ask. I have a job where I have to be on my feet a lot. I want to be stylish. There is absolutely nothing out there that somebody can be, where you can be comfortable and stylish at the same time. If you go on the shoe websites and you click on comfort, these things are so ugly. I mean, I feel like if I got out a pencil and paper, I could just design myself a stylish shoe that was comfortable. I just don't get it. Why is it not there?
Well, Marilyn, you're not alone in that. let me see what Rochelle has to say. See if she's gotten to the bottom of this. What do you think, Rochelle?
Well, I do think when our ideal is a stiletto, it's very difficult to make a shoe that is foot-friendly and also speaks to that ideal. I think a lot of companies are trying. I think the person who makes a really sexy shoe that also is foot-friendly is going to be a bazillionaire, you know? but practicality tends not to be sexy. I mean, that's a fundamental divide that it's going to be hard to breach.
So a funky pair of sneakers, perhaps, Marilyn. I don't know.
I like wedges. I like wedges for comfort because they give you that little bit of elevation, but they also don't make you balance in quite the same way as a high heel does.
Good luck, Marilyn. Thanks for calling into Radio Times. And, Rochelle, it's interesting. I'm older than you. How wedges go in and out of style. And when they're out of style, they look so terrible. But when they're in style, they look so good.
It's true. I mean, they're a bulky shoe. They're a very specific look. And of course, wedges like a platform, as you say, they come in and out of style. They are not necessarily ultra sleek or feminine. You know, that's not why people are wearing them. But I do think they're more comfortable than a high heel for the most part.
Let's get Rick from, looks like, Bound Brook, New Jersey to join us. Rick, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, how are you?
Good. How are you?
The sexiest shoe, I would say, was the clog. It was a great shoe for women, functional. They looked great in them. And I would say that the ugliest shoe known to man was the Birkenstock.
And, Rick, what do you wear?
I would disagree with your previous caller about the men's shoes. There are some outstanding men's shoes out there and always have been for the last 30 years. So I would disagree with him. I think they do a great job.
And are you kind of a shoe guy, Rick?
I am a shoe guy, both men, and I love seeing clogs on women, and I love seeing the old Dr. Scholl's wooden soled sandal that they used to sell. That was a great look on a woman.
Oh, that's great, Rick. Well, let me see what Rochelle has to say. Rochelle, what do you think?
Well, if all men were like Rick, I think women would be very happy. If we'd all be running around in clogs and Dr. Scholl's orthopedic shoes and feeling great. You know, it's great that he respects a comfortable shoe. I think we need more men like you.
Well, Rick, I have to say that our engineer, Kevin, is shaking his head. No. Just had to say that. Let's get Mark from Westlawn to join us. Mark, go ahead. You're on Radio Times. Go ahead, Mark.
Yes, I was wondering if you knew as when you wrote the book about this story and situation with the Confederate Army. Actually, they came to Pennsylvania in search of Hanover, Pennsylvania, because they knew there was a shoe factory there, because they were looking for shoes for the troops, but they stumbled upon the Union troops in Gettysburg, and that's where the whole start of the Gettysburg battle began.
I didn't know that story. That's great.
And then just as a sideline, sure. I'm an officer in the military, and I have about 30 pairs, but mine go the gamut from aerobic shoes to combat boots. So,
and I like your knowing laugh there, Mark. We appreciate that phone call to Radio Times. Thanks so much.
I'm going to have to look into that.
Yeah, indeed. You also went, Rochelle, to the Shoe Museum in Toronto. Is it Bata, B-A-T-A?
It's Bata, yes.
Bata.
That is a very cool museum. I recommend any shoe person to take a trip because it's extremely well curated. The wall text is very informative. They have everything from just beautiful Roger Vivier stilettos from the 1950s to, you know, those crazy moon boots worn by Elton John in the 1970s. It's interactive. They have shoes that you can put on. And I interviewed the senior curator there, and she's brilliant. She knows so much about shoes.
Well, in fact, you have a funny story about crossing over customs between Canada and the United States, and I guess the agent or the inspector there was thrilled that you had gone to the shoe museum in Toronto, not knowing there was one.
Yeah, she was a young woman, and as you know, anyone who's ever crossed the border knows they can be very stern and intimidating. And she was rapid fire asking me and my husband questions. And when she asked what I was doing in Toronto, I said I was going to the Shoe Museum to do research for my book. And her demeanor completely changed. Her eyes lit up, a big smile came across her face, and she said, "Oh my God, there's a shoe museum?" And we were, you know, for those 3 minutes, we were the best of friends. I told her I was writing a book on shoes. She said she had to read it. And, you know, that's what shoes can do. They can break down barriers.
So did you have fun doing research for this book?
I did. It was really fun. It wasn't always glamorous. A lot of people think I, you know, spent a lot of time in beautiful shoe stores. I spent a lot more time in the New York Public Library reading old magazines and newspapers. But, you know, it's a great topic, and I loved it.
And you said your husband tolerates your many pairs of shoes. Is he have, like, you know, two in the corner, or do you allow him some space in your apartment?
He used to have two in the corner, not because there wasn't space, but because he wasn't that interested in shoes. But, of course, over the past few years, as I've been doing this work, he has become a little bit more of a shoe person himself. So, you know, we do have to wrestle for space a little bit, but we make it work.
Well, Rochelle, thanks so much. It's been a lot of fun having you with us on Radio Times.
Oh, thank you. This has been great.
And her book is called Women from the Ankle Down, The Story of Shoes and How They Define Us. Rochelle Bergstein, our guest. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us. And we had to close things out with Paul Simon and, of course, his wonderful song, Diamonds on the Soles of Her Shoes.
Kodwa sensukile zanamhla awa awa sibona kwenzeka kanja awa awa amantombazane ayazo.
She's a rich girl, she don't try to hide it. Diamonds on the soles of her shoes. He's a poor boy, empty as a pocket, empty as a pocket with nothing to lose. Sing ta-na-na, ta-na-na, she got diamonds on the soles of her shoes.
Oh, oh, oh,
ta-na-na, ta-na-na, she got diamonds on the soles of her shoes.
Oh, oh, oh,
diamonds on the soles of her shoes.
Oh, oh, oh,
diamonds on the soles of her shoes.
Oh, oh, oh,
diamonds on the soles of her shoes.
Oh, oh, oh,
diamonds on the soles of her shoes.
And of course,